You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
33 years ago today, at a missile silo near Damascus, Arkansas, a simple mistake during routine maintenance on a Titan II missile almost caused an explosion. The Titan was the most powerful weapon in the United States nuclear arsenal and could have wiped out the entire state of Arkansas and sent radioactive fallout across the country. In his latest book, Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident and the Illusion of Safety, Eric Schlosser reveals that although this disaster was narrowly avoided, it was just one incident in an ongoing pattern of near misses that could have brought America to the brink of nuclear catastrophe. It's published by the Penguin Press. I'm very pleased that it has brought Mr. Schlosser back to our show today.
Thanks for having me.
And you have you wrote about the fast food industry and your bestseller Fast Food Nation, Marijuana Prohibition and Reefer Madness. Neither of those prepared me for a book from you on nuclear weapons safety. Yeah.
Well, these are all about subjects that powerful bureaucracies would rather that you not know about. And in looking back at the history of the Cold War and even until the present day, it's remarkable about how much misinformation and disinformation and outright lying the government has done about the management of our nuclear weapons.
Your title, Command and Control, is a military phrase. What does it mean and how does it apply?
It's really the process of making sure that you can use your weapons always when you want to use them, and also make sure they never go off or they don't get stolen or they're not used by someone down the chain of command without proper authorization. And it's a real challenge with nuclear weapons, and it has been since the very beginning of the nuclear era. The very first nuclear device, which was being tested at the Trinity site in 1945, was a threat of accidentally detonating because of a lightning storm. And really, it's been a great challenge having these weapons and not having them go off on our own soil.
The narrative thread throughout this book is that incident in Damascus, Arkansas, on September 18, 1980. What happened?
What happened was there was just routine maintenance being done on the missile, and a worker was on a platform near the top of the missile. This is the biggest missile that we ever built. It was like a 10-story building. He was working, and the socket fell off of his wrench. It bounced on the platform. He reached to grab it, missed, and it fell between a very narrow gap between the platform and the missile, went all the way down the silo, bounced, came back up, hit the missile, pierced the skin of the missile, and caused a massive fuel leak. And I spoke to people who've worked on that missile for years. They said that if you had deliberately tried to throw that socket down the silo and hit the missile that way, you couldn't have done it. It was a completely freak accident, but it put the Air Force in a terrible situation because on top of that missile was the most powerful nuclear warhead that we've ever put on a missile, and they really didn't know what to do.
It was a lot more powerful than the bomb we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
The warhead on that Titan II missile was three times more powerful than all the bombs used by all the nations in the Second World War, plus both atomic bombs combined. If that thing had detonated, it would have created immense firestorms that would have consumed Arkansas, and lethal radioactive fallout would have covered much of the eastern United States.
So how were we spared?
We were spared, in one sense, by the competence of our weapons designers, who put in safety mechanisms, and also by pure luck. And again, in the interviews that I did for this book, and I one of the things about the book is most of the books written about nuclear weapons have been about Oppenheimer or Teller or, you know, Henry Kissinger's memoirs, the high-level people. And this is a book about the day-in, day-out management of our nuclear weapons. So I interviewed people who designed them, people who repair them, the missile crews, the bomber crews, who handle them on a daily basis. And just about everyone I interviewed was amazed that no major city has been destroyed since Nagasaki, and ultimately a fair amount of good luck it can be responsible for it.
Was anyone hurt or killed in Damascus?
Yes, people were hurt. And I get into the story of these young airmen You know, we're talking about 19, 20, 21-year-old kids responsible for working on nuclear weapons. Some of them were hurt, and one of them was killed, and they showed remarkable personal heroism going into a very dangerous situation to try and save this missile.
Now, what happened was the missile exploded,
yeah,
but its nuclear warhead landed about 100 feet from the complex's entry gate and didn't go off?
The nuclear warhead did not go off, because we all would know if it had, but it was propelled a pretty good height into the air. And when the missile exploded, it created a fireball that went about 1,000 feet up into the air. And
Did that happen without detonating the warhead?
Nuclear weapons are incredibly complex machines, and a certain series of things has to happen for one of them to detonate. But a fire at that period, this was a very old warhead. It was an obsolete weapon system. A fire or an explosion could have detonated it. In this case, it didn't. But you wouldn't want to throw a nuclear warhead like that 1,000 feet up in the air and have it come crashing down to see how many times you could do it before one went off. We were very, very fortunate. And, you know, in the book I write about how many instances there have been in which we've come close to American weapons detonating on American soil. And the law of averages dictates that if you continue to have these sort of incidents, at some point you're going to have a major detonation.
And they continue into the near present.
Unfortunately, to this day, we continue to have trouble managing our nuclear arsenal.
But do we have any idea of how many of these incidents actually have occurred? Because we are talking about an area that is generally not only top secret, but top secret.
Yeah. The Department of Defense issued a list of broken arrows, what they consider serious nuclear accidents.
Broken arrow is the phrase they use?
Broken arrow is the phrase they use. And there are 32 of those accidents on their list. But through my own research and through the use of the Freedom of Information Act, that number is a small fraction of the actual number that occurred. One document that I got, which was a report done by the Sandia National Laboratory, one of our weapons labs, listed at least 1,200 of our nuclear weapons involved in accidents of one kind or another. And, you know, in the book I go into other incidents in which, you know, we lost effective control of our nuclear weapons.
How many of those 1,200 took place in our own country?
That's a good question. In this document, they don't always say where it occurred, but a large number have happened in this country. And some of the less dramatic accidents have been some of the more dangerous, in which you have short circuits. All you need to do is provide electricity to the detonators of a nuclear weapon, and it can set it off, and we've come close.
I'm talking with Eric Schlosser, who's the author of the New York Times bestsellers Fast Food Nation and Reefer Madness. His latest is Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. You write about another incident earlier, January 1961, when a B-52 bomber carrying nuclear weapons broke apart midair over Goldsboro, North Carolina.
Yeah.
Now, both of these incidents took place in the South. Is there any coincidence there?
You know, it's just there are a lot of military bases there. There was a nuclear weapons accident that happened in New Jersey, and the actual danger of that was never really honestly revealed. But civil defense authorities in New York City were prepared for either an accidental detonation or a cloud of plutonium that could have come from New Jersey over to New York City.
Again, so I feel less safe than I did before you said that.
But the government wanted to cover up these details because, firstly, they wanted to avoid embarrassment. And secondly, they didn't want the public to begin questioning our nuclear policies. And one of the reasons I've written this book is there needs to be a public debate and discussion on what we do with our nuclear weapons, how many we have. And people need the information to be able to have that debate.
So what happened in Goldsboro in 1961, that B-52 bomber?
It was a few days after the inauguration of John F. Kennedy, And a bomber was flying with two very powerful hydrogen bombs. It began to have trouble and prepared for an emergency landing, and while preparing for an emergency landing, started to break apart in midair. And the centrifugal forces of the plane breaking apart in midair pulled a lanyard in the cockpit. And that's the lanyard that one of the crew members would pull in order to release a hydrogen bomb over an enemy target. So the bomb had no way of knowing that it was over North Carolina and not over the Soviet Union. And it fell from the plane, and it went through all of the proper steps to detonate, except for one. And that one, there was one switch that prevented it from detonating. That switch was later found to be defective. And I interviewed the late Robert McNamara, who had literally just taken office as Secretary of Defense. And this one incident scared him to his core because, and I mean, you know, there's all this counterfactual what if, but that would have changed the course of history. The detonation of that bomb there really could have spread a lethal fallout as far north as Washington, D.C. and New York City.
On the other hand, if we were at war and we had planned to drop that bomb and it didn't go off, that would have been a problem as well.
It would have. And you've really hit on what the one of the central challenges is in designing nuclear weapons. The military want these weapons to always go off when they're dropped. And a lot of the civilian weapons designers want them never to detonate by accident. So you have this tension and when you're designing a weapon, that the kind of characteristics that would make it always go off are very different from the kind that would make it never go off, so that safety mechanisms might actually turn the bomb into a dud. And again through our history in the book, I look at how the military dictates again and again triumphed over some of the safety dictates. And we were operating nuclear weapons and had them routinely in the air and on our missiles that today you would never be permitted to remove from a bunker because of how you know, at risk they were of accidental detonation.
How difficult was it to get, not to, in talking to the people you talked to, we'll get to that in a moment, but how difficult was it getting information that is classified of this sort? You can't just make a FOIA request, can you?
Yeah. Well, I did make FOIA requests. And there's a wonderful organization, a nonprofit in Washington, D.C., called the National Security Archive, which has been collecting classified documents and making them available to the public for years now. So their archive was useful to me, but I also obtained many hundreds of pages of documents through the Freedom of Information Act. It took a long time for them to be delivered. Many of them were heavily excised and censored, but I was able to compare different documents and see what had been eliminated from the documents. Again and again, what had been censored was information that would not threaten the national security, but would threaten national security bureaucracies with embarrassment. And, you know, I was very fortunate that there were weapons designers, former Pentagon officials, people who'd work with these weapons who were willing to talk to me. And it's interesting that, you know, in the year 2013, the biggest opponents of nuclear weapons, the most anti-nuclear people in this country, are in their 70s, in their 80s, even in their 90s, and they have firsthand experience of these weapons. Whereas, you know, 33 years ago, when there was a nuclear freeze movement, the people who were anti-nuclear were 18, 20, 25. So there's a big gap in awareness about this issue, and I think that a kind of amnesia has settled in on this country. People need to realize these weapons are still out there. They're on alert. They're ready to be launched within minutes, and the public needs to be aware of this and get engaged with the debate about it.
Well, I get the sense that people who have worked on our nuclear programs over the years all come, or almost all, Edward Teller being one of the yeah. rare exceptions, come to have strong negative feelings about
yeah.
it. Going back to the people who worked on the Manhattan Project, almost all of them joined the anti-nuclear movement at
Absolutely.
One point or another.
And it's remarkable to now have people like Henry Kissinger and George Shultz, members of Republican administrations who are speaking out against nuclear weapons and supporting the abolition of nuclear weapons. Very few people, thankfully, in some ways, have ever seen a nuclear weapon detonate outdoors. The last outdoor test, atmospheric test we did, was in 1962. So that means the only people who have seen it happen are now in their 70s. And there was a former director of the Los Alamos Laboratory, Harold Agnew, who I interviewed, and he said that if he could, he would have every world leader gathered and make them watch the detonation of a hydrogen bomb, because that would really convince them that these weapons are too powerful and terrifying to ever use.
We'll take a little break. My guest is Eric Schlosser. His latest book is Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. It's published by the Penguin Press. We're back with Eric Schlosser. His latest book is Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. It's published by the Penguin Press. And as you mentioned, throughout the book, you relate the experiences of many enlisted soldiers who were involved in the nuclear weapons program one way or another during the Cold War. How dangerous was a job was it for these servicemen to work with nuclear weapons?
It depended on the job, but the servicemen who worked on the Titan II missile had one of the most dangerous jobs in the Air Force.
Now, it's been decommissioned. Is it because of the Damascus incident?
That was one of the reasons. And one of the unfortunate things is that the missile was already obsolete and long obsolete by the time the accident happened. But in the post-Vietnam War era and defense cutbacks, they kept this weapon on alert long past the time it should have been retired. The propellants, the rocket fuel that it had, were so dangerous that the men working on it had to wear these outfits that really looked like spacesuits, you know, with a bubble helmet and an air pack, et cetera. And what they had to deal with was extraordinary, especially after the accident happened. I mean, people volunteered to go back into this missile silo that was heavily contaminated with lethal fumes that not only would kill you if you breathed them in, but the slightest spark could set them off and create an explosion. So in the book, I really try to tell not just this story, but a lot of stories of personal heroism. We don't think of the Cold War veterans necessarily of having risked their lives or lost their lives in the Cold War. And one of the things I try to do in the book is honor the sacrifice. You know, these are incredibly young people with extraordinary responsibility when it comes to nuclear weapons.
And you suggest that there should be some kind of a monument in Washington, D.C. for the soldiers who died as a result of the Cold War arms race.
I do. I think there should be some sort of Cold War memorial. There were people who died trying to prevent nuclear weapons from detonating, and there were people who died, you know, as part of our deterrence. You know, bomber pilots and crews who were flying planes who were ready to go attack the Soviet Union at a moment's notice. And, you know, I consider myself quite politically liberal, but the caricature of these guys as these warmongering right-wing nuts doesn't fit the reality. There were a lot of very thoughtful people who were aware of the implications of their jobs, who took quite seriously their need to protect this country and literally paid the ultimate price for it.
What about the soldiers who were simply ordered to witness nuclear tests and who stood a lot closer than I would want to stand to the blast?
I spoke to some of them. I mean, they would be, they'd set off a nuclear weapon and they were doing psychological tests on these soldiers because they wanted to know how soldiers would respond in the battlefield if there were nuclear weapons being used on the battlefield. And so they would have to be in their trenches. They were deliberately told to stand and watch the detonation, you know, to really give them the visual effect. And then they were marched right up to ground zero.
Do you think things have changed now that drone warfare has kind of taken over the American strategy?
You know, one of my concerns and one of the big themes of the book is that we're much better at creating complex technology than we are at controlling it, ultimately. So the more technologically advanced we get, and particularly the more that our weaponry is reliant on computers and computer systems, the possibility for error is enhanced. And when you're talking about nuclear weapons, you're talking about the most dangerous machines that we've ever invented. So you want to have a kind of humility about our ability to control them once we've built them.
Now, you mentioned that some of these people were called warmongers. A prominent case is General Curtis LeMay. Wasn't he the model for George C. Scott's character, General Buck Turgidson, in the film Dr. Strangelove?
He was. And he was quite conservative politically. And he really did believe in a nuclear weapons strategy. If it looked like we were going to go to war with the Soviet Union, he wanted to hit the Soviet Union first with everything we had so that there would be no possibility of them launching anything against the United States. Now,
there were a lot of books that theorized what would happen. There was Herman Kahn's book. There was Henry Kissinger's book in which they try to do analysis on how many people would die in the Soviet Union versus how many people would die in the United States as a result of a retaliatory strike.
Yeah.
People were thinking along those terms.
Yeah, and in LeMay's case, I think he's gotten somewhat of a bad rap in the sense that there have been some writers who said he deliberately tried to provoke a war with the Soviet Union so that he could destroy it. And the reality is that he had firsthand experience of war. He had led bomber crews in battle during the Second World War. He had seen how Japan was destroyed, and he played a role in the firebombing of destruction. And he was actually motivated by an intense anti-war feeling, and he believed that if the United States had overwhelming military force, no one would ever dare to attack us. He was later an opponent of the Vietnam War, but once we were fighting it, he believed that you fight all out or you don't fight at all. You know, he was an opponent of limited wars. He said that limited wars aren't limited to the widows of, you know, those fallen in battle.
My guest is Eric Schlosser, who's the author of Fast Food Nation, now Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. It's published by Penguin Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the basis of nuclear policy for many years was MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction. And many people argued that it's what saved the world.
You know, what's interesting, and one of the things I look at a bit in the book, is the difference between the nuclear strategies that were publicly being discussed by the government and the actual targeting policies of the military. And although mutually assured destruction was talked about as a policy, and what that was that we have enough weapons, the Soviet has enough weapons, and we can destroy one another, and therefore we'll never launch one. In reality, our nuclear war fighting plan was very similar to the one that Curtis LeMay advocated in the 1950s. Through the Cold War, we were ready to strike first, to strike overwhelmingly, and try to destroy every one of their bombers, every one of their missiles before they could launch at us. And that's it's a very unstable policy to have because it means that you're under enormous pressure to shoot first and, you know, you might make a mistake and launch when you're not really under attack.
Did any presidents go along with that? Harry Truman fired Douglas MacArthur when he suggested using nuclear weapons against China during the Korean War.
Yeah. There was a constant attempt by the civilians in the Department of Defense and by one administration after another to gain control of our nuclear war fighting plan. But the military felt very strongly that this was their responsibility. And it's amazing how top secret our war plan was. In the book, I go on and describe how again and again civilians are given a glimpse of the plan, which is the biggest top secret that we have, and they're amazed at how many weapons are going to be used and where they're going to hit. Henry Kissinger, for example, made his reputation as a nuclear weapon theorist. He wrote best-selling books about it, and he became national security advisor for Nixon and went to Omaha and was given a briefing on our nuclear war plan, and he was stunned. He called it a horror strategy because of how many weapons would be used, how immediately they would be used. The plan was called the Single Integrated Operational Plan, or PSYOP was the acronym, which is a kind of a scary name for it. And one of the notable characteristics of it is once it was started, it couldn't be stopped. So again and again, civilians try to enter this world and adjust it. And it wasn't until the end of the Cold War, really, that major changes were made to our nuclear war plan.
Well, the popular culture looked at it in different ways. Early, we had movies like the Jimmy Stewart movie on the Strategic Air Command. Later, we had a bunch of movies of generals gone mad trying to force a nuclear war on the United States. But how accurate was the Strategic Air Command, other than the fact that Jimmy Stewart actually knew how to fly a plane?
Yeah. Well, the film that he made was a very rah-rah, patriotic portrayal of the Strategic Air Command. And, you know, later on, particularly in the 60s, the portrayal of the Strategic Air Command was in the opposite direction, as a bunch of warmongering right-wing generals. And the truth lies somewhere in between. What I found in writing this book is that the people involved in the Strategic Air Command were patriotic and well-intended. But what happened was, and this was something that Secretary of Defense McNamara said to me, each step seemed perfectly logical at the time, and step by step led us to a place of total madness. I mean, during the Kennedy administration, they did a study that suggested that we might need only 300 or 400 nuclear weapons in order to deter the Soviets from attacking us. And yet during the Kennedy administration, we reached the peak of our arsenal. We had 32,000 nuclear weapons.
And, of course, he ran on the missile gap.
Yeah.
There's a one of the people you write about is a man named Bob Purifoy.
Yeah.
And he wanted to develop safety mechanisms for nuclear weapons, but the military reacted to his efforts by resisting it.
Yeah.
Well, why were they resistant to safety devices?
Yeah. Bob Purifoy, who was a nuclear weapons designer at the Sandia National Laboratory, is one of the real heroes of the book because he realized in the late 60s, early 1970s, that there were significant safety problems with our weapons and began a bureaucratic battle to get safety mechanisms installed. The resistance came from a number of quarters from a number of reasons. The military didn't want safety mechanisms that might turn their weapons into duds or even make them slightly less reliable. But there was also a very strong sense of denial that there was a problem, because to admit that there was a problem would be to admit that we had potentially unsafe weapons for many years in our arsenal.
You write that in 2007, the U.S. Air Force lost half a dozen nuclear weapons for a day and a half. And then just 3 years ago, it was reported that an entire squadron of Minuteman missiles went offline and crews couldn't communicate with them for over 45 minutes. So how vulnerable is our nuclear command and control system to hacking or to just miscommunication?
We've had some real problems in recent years, and the 2007 incident was especially concerning because the Air Force lost control of six thermonuclear warheads for a day and a half. When they were removed from the bunker, nobody signed for them. Nobody knew they'd been removed. Nobody knew they'd been loaded on the plane. Pilot flew a bomber across the United States without knowing he or she had half a dozen thermonuclear warheads on board. Plane sat on a runway unattended. Those weapons could have been stolen. They could have been used by unauthorized personnel. So that happened in 2007, and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates really cracked down and fired the head of the Air Force, fired other officers, and was supposed to be sending a message. But 3 years later, in 2010, we had other safety problems. The incident that you mentioned, an entire squadron of 50 missiles was suddenly out of communication with its launch control centers for an hour.
That
raised the possibility in many people's minds that someone could hack into our nuclear command and control system and either disable our weapons or potentially launch one by hacking into the system.
Well, all of us have had experience problems with our computers when software and hardware fail. Should we be concerned that our intercontinental ballistic missiles are also controlled by computers that could be prone to software and hardware failure?
The Defense Science Board, which is a civilian advisory committee to the Department of Defense, issued a report this year that said that the vulnerability of our nuclear command and control system to being hacked has never been fully assessed. And during Senate testimony, the head of the United States Strategic Command this spring said he felt confident in the system, but we don't know what we don't know. Now, one of the things that concerns me is Snowden, a relatively low-level employee at the most top-secret intelligence agency that we have, was able to really get inside that system and remove their top secrets. There are private contractors who are working on our military command and control system. I'm not saying that this is a huge threat and it's going to happen tomorrow, but people need to be aware of the system that we have in place. And for too long, basic decisions about our nuclear weapons have been made by a very small group of decision makers in secret. And it's an urgent subject that needs public debate.
Are you saying that one rogue person, perhaps somebody like this shooter in Washington, D.C., who starts hearing voices, might very well be able to set off some kind of a nuclear explosion?
No, I don't think the concern is not somebody who's mentally ill. There are protocols in place. One of them is called a two-man rule, that you always need two officers in place in handling nuclear weapons. No, I'm much more concerned about a very smart, clever, premeditated person who understands these systems getting into them. And certainly for the hacking community, hacking the nuclear command and control system would be the ultimate hack. And I'm not saying it's going to happen next week, but if the Defense Science Board is concerned about it, I'm concerned about it.
Is the U.S. still developing nuclear weapons?
You know, under the Bush administration, there was a movement to come up with something called the Reliable Replacement Warhead. And this sounds incredible, but it was also being sold as an environmentally conscious warhead because even though it could destroy, you know, hundreds of square miles, it used less toxic materials. It didn't have any beryllium, which is very toxic. But no, right now we're not developing any nuclear warheads because in order for a new warhead to be put into service, you really need to be able to test it. And even though the Senate has not voted in favor of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, we're obeying it, and hopefully we will continue to obey it.
Well, we've run out of time, but I'm also concerned about the possibility of some accident occurring with one of the other programs in the world, India, Pakistan, North Korea. Russia no longer. Are they still aiming missiles at the United States, aren't they?
You know, Russia and the United States signed a protocol so that all of our missiles are aimed at open ocean. But they can be, in case there is an accidental launch, but they can be very quickly targeted to aim at one another's countries.
Eric Schlosser's book, Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety, is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.